Usually at this point I'd be walking over there. It feels funny. It's a much shorter walk. I'm so thankful to get to speak with you guys today. Maddie and I are so richly blessed to have a church like you guys. When we first showed up here, we showed up late when the service was ending and you took us to lunch right away. You'd never met us and you took us to lunch and we couldn't leave after that. There was no leaving. You let me start playing worship for you right away. I love getting to share that with you guys. When we were moving and we didn't have a house to live in because it fell through the day before we got married, my first thought was I need to call Pastor Chris because I bet you Grace Point can take care of us. And you did. In fact, from what I hear, you had like 5 or 6 contingencies in case the first one didn't work. When you have furniture, you think of us and you give it to us. You invite us into your homes. We're so thankful. So my hope this morning is to get to give back to you a little bit, a spiritual gift, because that's all we have. We're poor college students. If you'd like to open to Luke 14, verse 25, that's what we're going to be looking at today. Luke 14, verse 25. And I want to preface it like this. Pastor Chris's sermons these last many weeks has been out of Philippians about delighting in God, and I wanted to join him in that because that's something I really like. But I didn't want to review a passage he'd already preached. I didn't want to steal a passage from him. That felt wrong. So I went searching for a different passage, and this is the one I landed on. And I picked it because of this. In this passage, Jesus tells us who we are. You and me, we're disciples of Jesus. And he tells us exactly what we're like. In this passage, he's going to give us 2 qualities of what a disciple must be like. And it's such an encouragement because that's what you and me are. And then he's going to tell us how did we get to be that way? And we can rejoice in our salvation together. But before I do that, I've got to show you that you're a disciple, because Jesus uses that word, right? He uses the word disciple. And in our modern vocabulary, we use disciple as if it's a super Christian, right? Like there's Christians and then they're disciples. And disciples are on this next level. Like basically, like we use the word disciple like a disciple is something a Christian should attain to instead of something a Christian already is. But I don't think that's the way Jesus is using this term. I think there's definitely mature and immature Christians. He's just not using that term. And to show you, because I don't want to just tell you, that would be really unconvincing. To show you, I want to read you some verses from Acts. That's the other book that Luke wrote. And the way he uses this term will show you the way he uses the term disciple in Luke 14. First from Acts 6, verse 2, if you want to write them down so you can go back and check me. Acts 6, verse 2 says this, "And the 12 apostles summoned the full number of the disciples and said, 'It's not right that we should give up preaching the word to serve tables.'" Now, what happened here is not that the apostles grabbed all of the extra good Christians and told them their plan and told the rest to stay at home. He's just gathering the church, but he calls them Christians. If you go down just a couple lines to Acts 6, verse 7, it says this, "The word of God continued to increase, and the number of disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem." This isn't mature Christians multiplying in Jerusalem. Nobody's more than 3 weeks old as a Christian in Jerusalem. Jesus just died. Christianity's brand new. But he uses the word disciple. A couple more. Acts 9, verse 26. This is now about Paul. Acts 9, 26 says this, "And when he, Paul, had come to Jerusalem, he attempted to join the disciples, and they were afraid of him because they didn't believe that he was a disciple." Now, Paul is not trying to join the mature Christian small group, and they're not sure he's good enough yet. That's not what's going on. Paul's trying to join the church, but they're not sure he's actually a Christian because he was just trying to kill them a couple days ago. It makes sense. I'd be worried too. But he's using the word disciple. He's using the word disciple much like we would use the word Christian. And that happens because of Acts 11, 26. Acts 11, 26, the very last clause, it says, "In Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians." The outsiders in Antioch, they look at the disciples. That's what they're calling themselves. Disciples of Jesus versus disciples of a different rabbi. So the Christians are calling themselves disciples. And the outsiders, they look at them and say, "We call you Christians. You're like little Christs representing him here now. And we like that term a lot better. So we go with it because there's no disciples anymore because there's no rabbis running around." If there was rabbis running around, we'd probably still call ourselves disciples. So what's glorious about this is that when I read this this passage from Luke 14, this means that you're a disciple. Because the way that term gets used is just the same way we use the term Christian. Christians are disciples, disciples are Christians. So in this passage, when I read this, you and me were disciples. It's not about the super Christians out there somewhere that this passage is about. It's about you and me. So I'm going to read this now, after that long introduction. Luke 14, verse 25. It says this, "Now great crowds accompanied him," that is Jesus, "and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who will see it will begin to mock him, saying, "This man began to build and was not able to finish." Or what king, going out to encounter another king in war, will not sit down first and deliberate whether he's able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple." Now, like I said, you're disciples. And what Jesus does here is he gives you two qualities of what you are. But it's confusing to us because he states them in the negative. He says what you can't be if you want to be a disciple. And he does that for a reason. That first one's confusing to us especially. He must hate his own father and mother and wife and children. We don't like the words of that. We don't like it for a good reason. The consistent New Testament ethic is love, right? 1 John says, "If anyone does not love, he is not born of God, because God is love." It makes sense. Love is the New Testament ethic, but here Jesus says, hate these people. Why does he say, hate these people, and put it in the negative? He does it for a good reason. You and me, before we were disciples, we didn't have the experience of what it was like to be a disciple. So Jesus looks at a crowd full of not disciples, and he draws on their experience. He says, "You know how great it is to be a mom, to be a dad, to be a wife and a husband. You know how awesome it is to be kids of good parents, to be brothers and nice families. You know how great it is to have awesome friends. You know how much you like those relationships, how satisfying they are, how much you delight in those. In moments where you're with yourself and you feel confident and good about yourself, you know how pleasurable that is." He looks at all of this crowd of people and he says, "Think about how good that is." Being a disciple means loving God in a way that's so much greater and higher and different than that. It's as different as love and hate is. Being a disciple is so good, loving God in such a different way, huge way, only priority way, that it's as different as love and hate to those other relationships. That's hard to understand. So I came up with a good analogy, I think. This summer, on July 21st, Maddie and I, we got married. And some of you came. We were so glad that you came. And Pastor Chris came, and he did the wedding. And we invited about 250 people to this wedding. It was a big wedding. We had a big pavilion. We wanted to fill it. And lots of those people came. And then there were some people that weren't invited, but they still showed up. And I kind of knew those people, but I didn't really know those people. So after the ceremony, and Maddie and I, we went to the back of the pavilion, and there was kind of a receiving line where we could say, "Thank you so much for coming," and they could say, "Congratulations," and then the reception would start. Well, in that reception line, I was standing there, and some of these people that I hadn't invited, and I didn't know very well, they came up, and they gave me a hug, and they said, "Oh, congratulations, Nathan. I'm so happy for you. I love you so much." And I said, "I love you too," and they went on their way, and we've never spoken again. I don't know them very well. But a few hours later, the reception ended. And Maddie and I, we finally got out of the hot summer day and into an air-conditioned car, and we got some Mountain Dew in us. And I looked at her and I said, "Honey, I love you so much." And the love that I had for Maddie then versus the love that I had for that random guy I didn't invite, those are different enough. Those are as different as love and hate. And God says, your relationship with me, it's so different than every other fantastic relationship that you have. It's as different as love and hate. Now consider something. How good must being a disciple be if it makes those relationships like hate if loving God is love? I love being a husband. I think it's all that in a bag of chips. It is just fantastic. I love being a son of my parents. They're awesome. I love being a brother to my siblings. I like being a friend to all of you. And God looks at me, and Jesus here in this passage looks at us and says, loving God is so good, it will eclipse every one of those relationships. It's that good. And I say, that's something that I want. Imagine if you weren't a disciple and you heard this. You would say, that's something I want right now. How do I get it? But Jesus isn't going to, how do I get it right away? He's giving them a quality now about how disciples relate to God. Disciples relate to God with this kind of relationship that eclipses all of the rest. Now he gives us a second quality. The second quality, it's in verse 27. So the first quality there was verse 26 about hating. Second quality, verse 27. Verse 27 says, whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. This is another one that we get confused on, because we use bear your cross in a very different, strange way. We use bear your cross kind of like this. I would say something like, I've got this friend, and they're always down, and they're bringing me down, and they just make me feel sad and bad about myself, and I guess that's just my cross to bear. That's how we use that. But that's foreign to the Bible, right? People in 30 AD, when Jesus said this, they saw people bear their own cross. They knew what that was. You put the cross on your shoulder, you walk down the street, and they nail you to it, and you die. Right? People bearing their own cross are hours from death. So in this quality, Jesus gives a quality about what his disciples, how they relate to the world. He gave us one about how they relate to God. Now he gives us one about how they relate to the world. And he says, you relate to the world like you're bearing your own cross. For us to get it this morning, maybe imagine this. Imagine you're in the Middle East, and you've been a missionary there. And you've been witnessing, but now you've been found out. They know who you are. And they found you, and they've bound your hands, and you're walking down the street. And you can see up ahead the glint of a sword, and they're going to behead you. It's like 100 feet away. And now you're bearing your own cross, right? And someone runs up to you, and they shake you, and they say, I bought you a Lamborghini. Do you want it? No, I don't want it. I'm about to die. I'm 100 feet from someone who's going to behead me. What would I do with a Lamborghini? And they say, all right, I get it. How about a really big house full of super nice things? How would you like that? I would say, what would I do with that? I'm never going to live in it. And that's the point. Jesus says, my disciples relate to the world dead to it. They're like someone that's a second from death. They don't need this stuff. Now think about how good being a disciple must be. I'm not telling you to get rid of your stuff. This is what I'm telling you. Being a disciple is so good that it eclipses all of the things we like in this world. I love driving my car. I think it's a fun little car. I drive really fast in it every once in a while. I accelerate quick off of lights and lose to cooler cars. It's great. I like doing that. I like the apartment Maddie and I live in. I like the couches that we just got. And what God's telling me is that being a disciple is so much better, it's going to make me like I'm about to die to those things. So now what Jesus has told us in two qualities is that having a relationship with God, being a disciple, is so much better than anything else that it will make every other fantastic relationship that you like be eclipsed, and it will make all of the things that you enjoy, it'll make you dead to them. This is something that's incredible. It's something that we want, right? The good news is, I'm telling you, you have it this morning. You've got that thing. You're a disciple. But our question is then, why don't we experience that? Because if you're like me, on Monday morning when I started figuring out this passage, I was pretty depressed. I was thinking, I don't feel that way. I don't feel that way all the time about God, that he's the eclipsing passion of my life. I don't feel that way about the world most of the time, that I'm dead to it. Why don't I feel that way? And I came up with two reasons, and I hope they're helpful to you. On that first quality of having an eclipsing passion for God. The reason we don't experience that all the time is because we don't commit to God. At the root of love is commitment. That's why God, when he relates to humanity, relates in covenants, commitments to us every time. That's why in the most loving relationship that we know, marriage, it starts with a commitment where we look at each other and say, I'm going to love you and be faithful to you alone until they put me in the ground. Love is a commitment at its base. And so when we don't experience the love for God we want, it's because we act like a live-in boyfriend for him. And we say, I know that you've offered me all of this great stuff, and I know you're so committed to me, but like, I still want my space, and I want to be able to leave when I want to leave, and I'm not committing that much to you. Now, being a Christian means being a disciple means loving God like that and loving and being dead to the world like that. But when we don't commit, we refuse to take those benefits from God. We say, I'm good. Count me out on the best relationship ever. On the other quality, when we become a Christian, we buy the pearl of great price. And then we throw it in a garage, and we throw cars and houses and pride and lust and lying and our own selfish ambition over it. So then when we go look for the pearl of great price, it's lost in the rubbish of the garage. We can't find it. And it's because we've gone to look for satisfaction in things that we're dead to. When you became a Christian, God actually made you dead to the world. So you're not going to find satisfaction there. If you go looking for it, don't be surprised that it's not there. And I say those things specifically, that being a disciple means those things, because of a specific word that's here. And it gave me a lot of trouble. It's that last clause of verse 26 and the last clause of verse 27, cannot be my disciple. That's confusing for us too. We use the word can and cannot in strange ways sometimes. We would say something like this. As grandparents, I'm sure some of you, you've had this experience. Your grandkid, he comes to your house, you've got a cookie jar there, because every grandparent has a cookie jar. It's right there on the counter. We all know how it works. And your grandkid, he reaches up and he starts putting his hand in, and his mom's there and says, you can't do that. Can he do that? Yes, he can. He's got his finger in the jar already. He can do it. What she means is you ought not to do that. And that's not what Jesus is saying in this verse. It's true that we ought to act that way as disciples. That's totally true. But it's just not what Jesus is saying in this passage. And it's not what he's saying because of a very specific Greek word. And I hate mentioning the word Greek in sermons because it makes me feel like there's a disconnect between me and you. But I'm going to teach you Greek really quick this morning so that you understand it. You only need to know two words, so you can repeat after me. Ouch. That was pretty good. It's got to be more in the back of your throat. Ouch. Ouch. And dunetai. Dunetai. Ouch means not. Super easy to remember. Dunetai means to be able. When Jesus says in the Great Commission, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth, he uses the word dunamis. All authority, all power, all ability has been given to me. Therefore, you, as you go, make disciples. I'm giving you my ability. Here in this verse, it says, anyone who doesn't hate his father and mother, wives and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he, ouch dunamis, to be my disciple. He isn't able to be my disciple. To state that in the positive means to be a disciple means to be that way, to have that eclipsing relationship with God. It's the definition. To be a disciple means to have this relationship with God, and to be a disciple means to be dead with the world. They're necessary, which means that we've got to figure something out. Why don't we feel that way? Because you and me were disciples, and we don't feel that way. But Jesus is telling us this. It's who we are. And this, I think, the answer to the whole conundrum we're in, I think is what Pastor Chris preaches to you day in, day out, for the last 11 years, and for the rest of his life while he's here. It's exchange your shame for your glory. Exchange this old life that you were living before you were a disciple for being a disciple. If that phrase doesn't ring with you, maybe this one will. You need to act like you're dressed. Before, you were dressed as a normal person, but now God dressed you like a disciple. You've got to act like a disciple if you want to feel like a disciple. That's how it works. You are these things. You and me, we are. That's incredible to me because I don't feel that way all the time, but I've got to trust that it's true because it's right here, and we've got to learn to act like disciples. And our question is, how does this kind of come together for us? Good news is Jesus tells us. Our being disciples came together like this. Jesus uses a parable. He says it's kind of like a guy that was making a tower. And before you make a tower or you build a house, what do? You check your bank account and make sure you can pay for this thing, because nobody wants a framed up house. That's not keeping the rain out. So before you build a house, and in this analogy, the house is discipleship. Before you build a house, you count and you check your bank account. Do you have enough to pay for it? And what we're supposed to do is not the self-help thing of, do I have the emotional ability? Can I commit enough for it? That's not what Jesus is saying. What he's saying is count your resources. Do you have enough money to pay for this thing? Discipleship's this good. You saw how good it is. Better than every other relationship, so much so you'll forget about them almost. Better than everything in the world, so much so you'll be dead to them. You want that? Pay for it. What do you have? And we say, if we were a first century Jew, my dad, he helped you build your house. Do you remember that? They use their network. And when Jesus looks at him and says, do you remember the first quality? Your father and mother, you hate. That's not on the table. You might be able to be a disciple of a different rabbi, one of the Pharisees, by your dad having built my house, but that doesn't work here. You're not going to get to be a disciple of me by who you know. And then maybe we'd say, all right, well, I'll get you food. I'll get you clothes, whatever you need. And he'd say, remember, my disciples, they're bearing their own cross. They're dead to the world. So what do you have to offer me? And now we've got a really tough situation because we have something as incredible as discipleship here and a cost that we can't pay. And I don't know about you, but that makes me really sad because discipleship's incredible. And Jesus answers his own question. He says, all right, you don't have what it takes. You counted the cost and you came up way in the red. You've got nothing near what it would cost to buy discipleship from me. So then he says, therefore, because discipleship is this good, because you can't pay for it, therefore, anyone who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. That's verse 33. Now, how does that tie together? We got on one end, discipleship is this fantastic, I really want it. We've got on the other end, the price is too high to pay for it. How does renouncing tie those two things together? I think the answer is this. Renouncing is faith. What do we do in justification by faith? We look up at God and we'd say, I'm a filthy, wretched sinner with no way of purchasing my salvation for myself. So I renounce all that I have, like what Paul would say in Philippians 1, if you remember. I count everything as loss. In Philippians 3, he would say it as, I count everything as rubbish for the surpassing joy of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. So I renounce everything, and God, I look at you and I trust you to somehow secure my salvation by Jesus' sacrifice. And that's what Jesus tells us right here in 33. He says, discipleship is this amazing. Here's the two qualities. Here's how my disciples relate to God. It's the best relationship you'll ever have. Here's how my disciples relate to the world. They've got better than anything it has to offer. And you can't buy it. But if you want it, you have faith. You renounce everything that you have, and you have faith that someone else takes care of it for you. And that's how you be my disciple. And that's how you and me got to be disciples this morning. But sometimes we forget the first part, the two qualities. We say, I'm disciples, so because I did the renouncing, I'm good on the heaven thing. And we forget about the qualities. What Jesus did in making you a disciple, what that means is that you have a relationship with God that's so different than every other fantastic relationship, it's as different as love and hate. That's what you have. It's what you are. It's what it means to be a Christian. And then he says, my disciples, they're dead to the world. It's what they are. So that's the way we are too, to a small degree. And we want it to be a bigger degree, right? Because if being a disciple is this much of a joy, you probably only get this much if you only commit a little bit. That's all you're going to get. So my plea to you this morning is to think about being a Christian a little bit different way. Becoming a Christian wasn't your get out of hell free card. It's not what happened. When you became a disciple of Jesus, those two things in verse 26 and verse 27 happened. You got a relationship with God so good that it eclipses all of your other relationships. He's your only priority now. And then you got something so good, you can die to all the things in the world. And my plea to you is to please act that way. That's what you want. I promise that's what you want. Some of you are in the opposite place as me. You finished your career, and now you've got a few years left. Moses would say that you've got, how does it go? 70, if by reason of strength, 80, if by reason of modern medicine, maybe more. You're at the end of the journey, but that doesn't mean it's too late to be this way. These two qualities, they've been you since you were converted. This is what happened at conversion. He took you from someone that could only find fulfillment in relationships with other people and stuff in this world, and he changed you into a disciple who's not that way. That's why it's so dangerous to act that way. It's anti-discipleship. That's why Pastor Chris is always warning you about American materialism, because that's you trying to find satisfaction in something else. That's us trying to find satisfaction in something else. So my plea to you is to not do that. Enjoy the end of the journey like this, in these qualities. That's the most satisfaction. Some of you are where I am. You're just starting the journey. You just got married. You're not even out of college. You're graduates. And we've got a whole life ahead of us that we could live like this. This is the only way of satisfaction for us now. That's it. God took your taste buds and he changed them, so your taste buds are set on God now. You're not gonna get satisfied by anything else. That's what I have for you this morning. For the first time practicing this sermon, I made it to exactly 25 minutes. It was 35 before, so God was good to you this morning. Let me pray for you. God, thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to these, my brothers and sisters, this morning. Thank you for them listening. And I pray, God, you would convict us in a way that doesn't lift off of us. Sometimes, God, when we're convicted, we try to get unconvicted because we don't want to change. Holy Spirit, I pray you would convict us in a way that doesn't let us shake it. We can't get it off our minds and hearts. To act like the disciples you've already made us. People who hold you in our highest affection in relationships, and people who are dead to this world looking forward to the one you're making next. It's in your glorious name that I pray. Amen.